The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
New York City is struggling to deal with a surge of migrants. There's not enough beds, so they're being sent to a cruise terminal in Brooklyn.
Immigrants are sleeping on camping cots, they have no privacy, and there aren't enough bathrooms.
Also ahead, it's not just any old soup. People book airplane tickets to southern Turkey to get a taste of a special brothy stew of lamb and rice.
We got off the plane, we left the luggage, we were here for like 24 hours just for this.
Plus, a visit to one of Europe's hottest real estate markets.
Milano is booming, absolutely booming.
The boom in Milan is partly being fueled by Brexit, and it's taking a toll on Italian families just trying to find a place to live. I'm Carol Hills. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Many of us woke up to this rather unusual news.
Tensions are rising between the U.S. and China over a suspected Chinese surveillance balloon that is...
Questions over the Chinese surveillance balloon. It's floating high over Montana.
You kind of can't ignore a giant balloon in the sky, over a big sky, that's believed to be spying for China. The White House responded today by postponing a diplomatic trip to China by Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Beijing is calling it an innocent mistake, a civilian airship blown off course. Anthony Ruggiero has been following this diplomatic snafu. He's a former National Security Council advisor and now a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. Anthony Ruggiero, how big of a deal is it for the White House to cancel Secretary of State Blinken's trip?
Well, it's a big deal. I think we should start with it's the right call at this point. You know, this would have been the first trip really in 4 years by this senior of an official from the United States. I think this was an effort by the administration to try and work with China. They think there are some issues where we can work together. There are some issues where the Biden administration believes that we're in a competition. You know, the real question is, does China believe that? And given the balloon and doing it at this moment, it's likely that China doesn't agree with that kind of framework.
Now, this is kind of a diplomatic minefield for both countries. Tell us more about what the Chinese said today and if the U.S. is buying their excuse.
You know, China claimed that it was some kind of weather balloon or something of that sort that went off course. It's really hard to believe that that's what happened. You know, I certainly was in the National Security Council. You have strange things come across your desk, but the process is really the same. Assess what's going on. Try and think about the pros and cons of each option. You know, it sounds like this administration considered shooting it down, but rejected that, at least for now. But they're certainly monitoring it. But the real question in my mind is, why do this now? Why would, you know, Chinese leader Xi Jinping, knowing that there's going to be this big meeting with Blinken coming out there, and in the future, probably Secretary of the Treasury Yellen going there, why do this now? I think it's likely a test to see how the Biden administration would respond. So far, they have the right response, but this is an issue that's going to continue.
What was on the agenda for this meeting between Secretary Blinken and Xi Jinping?
You know, this administration, as I noted, has this, bifurcated approach to China and really thinking about the areas where there's a competition. You know, first on the list is China, you know, either assisting or at least looking the other way while Russia invaded and now is destroying parts of Ukraine. And then Taiwan would have been top of that list. And then when you look at the competitive areas that this administration believes that we can work together on, nonproliferation is probably on the top of the list. I put North Korea within that category, its nuclear and missile programs. Climate change is probably something else this administration thought that they could work together on. Now, to me, the real question on this is, does China see it differently? Does China see all of these issues as the competition? It's possible they do. And part of this is, you know, trying to see if this administration, you know, wanted to have just business as usual with this balloon, or would they have canceled the meeting, which is what they did. And again, I think that's the right call for right now.
So how badly does this balloon incident derail the important conversations that the Biden administration wants to have with China right now?
It's a little too early to tell because we don't know what the Biden administration is going to say are the conditions for rescheduling the meeting. You know, I can imagine that that's part of what the policy discussions are happening now. You know, for example, are they going to insist that China not have any of these balloons over the United States? That'd be a good first start. Are they looking for an apology or are they looking for other things? And then once that is either stated in public or in private, will China even do any of those things? Essentially preconditions to reset the meeting. So I think that's what we're going to see come together in the next few days.
Anthony Ruggiero is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's been briefing us on the diplomatic tensions brought about by a balloon from China. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And later in the show, more on that balloon and a dive into the long history of balloons being used for spying and warfare. New York City has always been a draw for immigrants, but it's struggling to take in many more. About 44,000 migrants have come through New York City's official intake system since last spring. And Mayor Eric Adams says the city is surpassing the highest number of people ever recorded in its shelters.
And every day going forward that we add more to this count, we break another record.
This week, the city ordered hundreds of single men to move to a new reception center at a cruise terminal on the Brooklyn waterfront. Many refused to go. Others went. Reporter Gisele Regatao went to the new shelter site this week and spoke to some of the people who are moving there. Gisele, tell me about what you saw.
This new reception center is inside a massive cruise terminal in the Red Hook neighborhood. Immigrants are sleeping on camping cots, they have no privacy, and there aren't enough bathrooms. The site is supposed to house 1,000 men until May 1st, when cruise ships will be back. One interesting detail, Carol, is that the cruise terminals are right by the water. It faces the Statue of Liberty.
So remind us of the story behind this large influx of migrants to New York City.
Yes, this started last spring when other states like Texas and Arizona sent buses of migrants to New York City. And since then, tens of thousands of people have continued to come. New York is a sanctuary city, so Mayor Eric Adams says the city will always welcome immigrants with open arms.
Now tell us who you met at this new shelter in Red Hook this week.
My colleague Vera Haller and I talked to a few immigrants. Many here are from Venezuela, like Jose Perez. He's 26 years old and is from Puerto La Cruz on the eastern coast of Venezuela. He arrived in New York 3 months ago. He used to work at a bank and was studying business administration in college. He says he decided to leave his country because he couldn't survive with what he was making.
No me alcanzaba para vivir. Él, créame, un sueldo mínimo en Venezuela son como de 7 a 10 dólares.
What he's saying here is, if you can believe me, the minimum wage in Venezuela is between $7 and $10 a month. And with that, I had to pay university, gas, car insurance. Perez says New York is not his first destination. His journey is quite incredible, Carol. He left Venezuela 4 years ago. First, he lived in Brazil, then Chile, then Peru, and finally Ecuador.
So how did he end up in New York then?
Perez crossed through the Darien Gap, which is this forest area between Colombia and Panama. It's quite dangerous. He came with several friends, and it took them 3 months to get here.
What he's saying here is that at night, as
people were setting camp, it looked like the apocalypse, that there was no food, and it was horrible. They arrived through El Paso, Texas, and I asked him why he came to New York City. He's saying he was told that New York was a sanctuary place, that he could be more at ease here, not like in other states in the U.S. Perez says that last year he worked at a company cleaning and repairing chimneys, but he's unemployed now. And his family, Carol, is spread all over the place. His wife is in Chile, his parents are in Venezuela, he has one sister in Colombia and another in Costa Rica. He says he hopes to stay in New York and to bring his whole family here.
That's amazing. His family, they're really spread all over the place at this point. Now, has Jose Perez applied for asylum? I mean, what are the chances that he will actually be able to stay in New York?
He hasn't applied for asylum yet. He told us that he has contacted a lawyer and he got an appointment for the end of this month.
Now, earlier this year, the Biden administration changed its policy toward migrants from four countries, including Venezuela. How is that changing the picture?
Now, people from Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua can no longer apply for asylum if they are in the U.S. They need to be able to buy a plane tickets, get a sponsor, and pass through a background check, among other things. So the number of people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border from these four countries is decreasing. But there are still about 200 migrants arriving in New York City every day.
Gisele Regatao has been reporting about Venezuelan migration with Vera Haller. Thanks so much, Gisele.
You're welcome.
In Spain, a fungal outbreak is spreading slowly but steadily. It's ringworm, and it's jumping from one human head to the other. Ringworm causes red, itchy, round rashes. More than 100 teenage boys in Spain have picked it up in 1 year alone. From Barcelona, reporter Jerry Haddon explains what's going on.
Little kids usually pick up ringworm from pets or even farm animals. But in 2021, dermatologist Leonardo Bascon started seeing something new.
Some patients were coming here with this new pattern, and they were a bit older. The mean age of our cases is actually 19.
Call it teen worm. Bascon and colleagues decided to investigate. They jumped on a nationwide online chat group for Spanish dermatologists. They asked, is anyone else seeing this?
Yeah, in just a week of calling them and searching for those cases, we collected 107.
The cases were spread out across the country, Bascon says, so they couldn't link it to geography. But then they found another clue.
It's affecting teenagers, and it appears to be related to them and the hairdressing thing.
That hairdressing thing, it's a haircut. A specific one that's all the rage. It's known as the degradado, or the fade. It so happens that every single one of the 107 patients had been to the barber to get a fade within 2 weeks of showing infection. In Spain, it seems virtually every teen boy sports the fade. Our own 16-year-old son, Nino, does. So do all of his friends and the guys on his soccer team. I talked to them after a recent practice. The fade starts out short on the sides, Nino explains. You leave it longer and longer as you move up towards the top of your head. The key, says teammate Nacho, is shaving all the way down to the skin around the ears and the nape of your neck. That shave down to the skin, that's when ringworm makes its move. The delivery device, a barber's electric razor. Barcelona haircutter Sukrit Singh says, lately I do a lot of fades, shaving the sides of kids' heads down to zero. Sometimes, he says, they also ask for patterns shaved into their hair down to the scalp. Singh says he hasn't had any cases of ringworm in his shop, but razors like his can pick up the fungus from the skin of one client and quickly spread it. I get 20 to 30 clients a day, Singh says. One could easily pass ringworm to another. This is a barbershop, after all, he says. We need to be vigilant. Singh, like most barbers, disinfects his razors and scissors with alcohol after each client, but apparently some don't. Dermatologist Leonardo Bascon says if you do get ringworm, it's easily treatable, but prevention is best. The fungus, he says, can cause inflammation, fever, and even bald spots. Imagine, he says, going to school with a bald spot.
They are very concerned about the problem. It could lead to alopecia, like if it's not properly treated, yeah.
Alopecia refers to an abnormal loss of hair. Doctors don't know how many cases of ringworm are out there beyond the 107 reported. Other outbreaks in Europe have been smaller. Last year, 7 people were infected at a barber shop in Wales. Germany and Denmark have seen similar caseloads. Bascon says Spain's is by far the largest.
Recuerda que la tiña es una infección causada por hongos.
Más de 100 casos de tiña entre
adolescentes. Hace una semana salió el tema de la
moda del degradado desata un brote de tiña en las peluquerías. ¿Qué está pasando realmente?
The news, understandably, has spread fast among teens. These are warnings on the video app TikTok. Some adolescents say they are worried, but so far it seems not enough to forego the fade. I've been avoiding the barber since I heard about ringworm, says Gael Donce, one of the high school soccer players I spoke to. But next week, he says, I'll be back in the barber's chair. These guys say from now on, they'll just ask the barber to disinfect the razor before they take a seat. And if they forget to ask, they say, they'll just hope the fungus hasn't found them. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The Canadian province of British Columbia is starting a pilot program to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of hard drugs like meth, crack cocaine, and heroin. It's part of a larger effort to reduce drug overdose deaths in the province. The three-year pilot program started this week. To discuss the program, I'm joined by Lisa Lapointe, chief coroner for the province. Lisa Lapointe, how bad is the overdose crisis in British Columbia?
Well, we started to see a significant increase in deaths due to illicit toxic drugs in 2015. The deaths increased substantially from 2015 to 2016, where we had almost 1,000 deaths. Since that time, we've seen more than 11,000 deaths in our province. And in the last 2 years, an average of 6 people dying every day due to the toxic illicit drug market.
Wow. Now, what is the link between decriminalization and overdose? How can decriminalizing these hard drugs, small amounts of them, how can that help reduce deaths in theory?
So as the BC Coroner Service, we are responsible for investigating all of these deaths because they are sudden, unexpected, unnatural deaths. And what we have learned is that the majority of people dying are people dying at home alone. They're ashamed of their substance use. They're afraid to ask for help. They're worried about the stigma and about losing their jobs or their families. These are people with jobs often in the trades or the transport industry. So really what decriminalization is an effort to shift the conversation from a punishing and blaming perspective, which we know has been unhelpful. We've seen the result of decades of that approach, to a health-focused approach. There are a number of other, I guess I could use the term, advantages as well. So one of the challenges with our market here in BC is that it is so very toxic. 82% of those who died this year died as a result of fentanyl in the, whatever they purchased. We know that people are purchasing potentially what they think is cocaine, and it contains fentanyl. They're not opioid users, and they die. Their system is overwhelmed reacting to the fentanyl. So it's also a means of allowing people to carry small amounts of drugs they've purchased. They can take it to a drug testing site. It can be tested. They can find out that it is safe for them, and now they are at far less risk of harm or dying.
Now, this kind of decriminalization program, it exists in other places in the world. Portugal has allowed people to possess small amounts of hard drugs for decades. And even the state of Oregon in the U.S., I think it's been legal to possess small amounts for a couple of years now. What have we learned from those case studies? Have they achieved the things that you are hoping for in this pilot program in BC?
Oregon, I know, has not achieved at this point what it was hoping to achieve. Frankly, that doesn't surprise me. This is a big shift, and it's going to take a lot of time. We now need to build the services for people to treat this as a health issue. So that's really a big move. Portugal, yes, has been very successful, certainly by all accounts, and some of the medical professionals that I've spoken to here, including our provincial health officer, is a very successful model.
You're the chief coroner for the province of British Columbia, so you see the effects of overdose firsthand. How does your role affect your perspective on this crisis?
It does make it much more personal. 2,272 people died last year, and to some people those are numbers, but to us those are individual people. We see those people. We see them where they have died in their homes, in their bedrooms, in their living rooms. We hear about them. We hear about what kind of people they were, and their loves and their hobbies and their work. And the public has this general idea of this out of control group that we need to monitor closely and they need to be policed. In fact, that's not true. The majority of people who are using drugs in our province are our colleagues. They're our friends. They're our neighbors. They're our co-workers. Estimates in our province are that 90 to 125,000 people are opioid dependent. So that's a lot of people. They are not seeking help in many instances because of the fear and the stigma.
Lisa Lapointe is British Columbia's chief coroner. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much for your time, Carol. I appreciate it.
In the Turkish city of Gaziantep, a local soup that takes 14 hours to prepare is drawing in foodies from across the globe. Beyran is a brothy stew of lamb and rice that's eaten for breakfast. It's one of several local dishes that makes this city on the border of Turkey and Syria one of UNESCO's creative cities of gastronomy. The World's Duri Buscarin has our story.
Real Beyran shops open at 5 a.m., early enough for shift workers to get a meal that keeps them full for the whole day. At Metanet Lokantası, just steps away from Gaziantep's old bazaar, Evren Olçen stands over a fragrant platter of lamb shank, spiced and slow-roasted. Next to him is a stack of shallow copper bowls, which he uses to assemble each individual serving. First we put some grease in the dish, and then we add the meat and some rice, he says. Then it's all cooked together. Each individual bowl is placed over an open flame on a gas burner, where a chef uses a ladle to anoint each one with a spicy, garlicky broth. The flame leaps over the side of the bowl and sets the whole dish aflame. Beyran is one of Gaziantep's most important dishes, says Mehmet Halafolu. He grew up in this small historic city, surrounded by pistachio orchards, not far from the Syrian border. He says this restaurant, Metanet Lokantası, makes the best Beyran in town. They've been here for as long as I've been alive, he says. It's a smaller restaurant with plain tile walls and long shared tables. A bowl of Beyran here costs less than $4, pricier than most, perhaps due to its fame, but still affordable. Gaziantep's history as a Silk Road trading hub and its use of local products like pistachios, hot peppers, and fresh yogurt make the food here particularly famous in Turkey. Zehra Albarak is visiting from Istanbul. Normally, I don't eat soup for breakfast, Albayrak says. It's not really my thing. But this is delicious. Thanks to her friend Mehmet, she says she's become a local. If you look around the world, soup for breakfast is not all that unusual. In Colombia, a brothy morning bowl of short ribs, potatoes, and herbs is known as caldo de costilla. In Vietnam, pho is served for breakfast, not dinner. Miso soup can be breakfast in Japan. And honestly, I would argue that oatmeal is basically soup. But Metanet chef Evren Olçen takes offense to the idea that what he makes belongs in this category. Beyran is not soup. This is a full meal, Olçen says. You can make soup in an hour, he says. But the meat in Beyran takes 14 hours alone. Beyran's status as a soup or not soup doesn't put a damper on tourist enthusiasm. In fact, many of Metanet's customers are Turkish foodies who have flown in just for the weekend. Aisha, a historical renovator who asks not to use her full name for her privacy, brought her family.
We got off the plane, we left the luggage, we were here for like 24 hours just for this.
But the trek, she says, was worth it. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin in Gaziantep, Turkey.
You're with The World. The Grammys are coming up this weekend. There's a new category, the best song for social change. One has lyrics that are resonating with people across Iran.
You hear everything from the ability to kiss their lover in the streets without fearing reprisal or the ability to dance.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in the Middle East this week. Violence between Israelis and Palestinians was at the top of his agenda. Washington isn't the only player that might mediate between the two sides. 2.5 years ago, Israel signed the Abraham Accords with several Arab nations. The Royal Shirin Jafari reports on their reaction to recent events.
The Abraham Accords made it possible for Israel and several Arab nations to have open and official diplomatic relations. President Trump made the announcement in 2020 at the White House.
To our honored guests from Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, congratulations on this outstanding achievement. Congratulations.
It was a big deal. For a long time, nearly every Arab nation refused normal relations with Israel. They insisted that the Palestinian cause be addressed first.
Now, what happened with the Abraham Accords is the chronology got reversed.
Hussein Ibish is with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Ibish says these countries saw numerous benefits in dealing with Israel. That includes expanded trade and business opportunities, tourism, and cultural exchanges. It's also about countering Iran's regional influence.
And right now, Israel is doing all the heavy lifting against Iran and its militia network in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, etc. So for them, it's a no-brainer.
The picture gets more complicated, though, when you take public opinion into consideration.
Every evidence we have is Arab publics remain very much supportive of the Palestinians.
Shibli Telhami teaches at the University of Maryland, and he's a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
And we've seen that, for example, in the World Cup recently, where, you know, states that have made peace with Israel, like Morocco, their national team, when they did well, when they won big games, they wrapped themselves in Palestinian flag. And you could see in the stands the degree to which there was solidarity.
Given this solidarity, a question that comes to mind is, what, if anything, can the Arab nations that signed the Abraham Accords do to help mediate between the Palestinians and Israelis?
We have seen statements coming out of Arab governments, including the United Arab Emirates and others. The problem is we're not seeing much more than simply making statements.
Khaled El-Kindi is the director of the Palestine program at the Middle East Institute. He says the UAE has taken steps in the past.
The Emiratis like to talk about how they convinced the Israelis to stop moving toward formal annexation in the West Bank.
This was about 2.5 years ago.
So they do have influence, they do have leverage.
But so far, at least publicly, tensions between Israelis and the Palestinians don't seem to have risen to the top of the agenda for these Arab states. El-Kindi points out that outside of the Gulf region, Arab countries like Jordan, Egypt, Tunisia, and Algeria are not engaged either. This is partly because they are dealing with a lot of domestic challenges.
This is a particularly difficult moment, I think, in the region, economically, politically, in so many ways. And so in a lot of cases, I think people are also distracted with more local issues.
There has been a shift in the way Arab countries see the Palestinian cause, says Joe Macaron, a Middle East analyst in Paris.
We have a new first generation of Gulf leaders that don't have the same emotional attachment to the Palestinian issue like the elder generation. Second, the focus has shifted completely to Iran as a major priority.
He says it doesn't help that the impasse between Israelis and the Palestinians has lasted so long.
You have this Palestinian division. You have an Israeli political elite unwilling to have talks or have the two-state solution. You have disinterested U.S. Arab leaders who are focused somewhere else.
So he says at the moment, the options seem limited. Meanwhile, Israel has been focused on adding more Arab countries to the Abraham Accords. This week, Israel's foreign minister traveled to Sudan to finalize an agreement there. The big name that remains off the list so far is Saudi Arabia. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Worldwide, around 700 million people use the messaging app Telegram. It was founded by an anti-authoritarian tech entrepreneur named Pavel Durov. Think the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia. Telegram became popular among dissidents. It's widely seen as a secure messaging platform. Except, well, it really isn't. A series of eerie arrests of anti-war activists in Russia have raised serious red flags about the platform. Reporter Darren Lucades dove into this mystery for Wired and joins us now. Darren, tell me the story out of Russia that really got people concerned about Telegram.
I wouldn't say that it was a single story. It's more of a critical mass of cases that have raised concerns among the opposition and activist community. But one case that was certainly very eye-catching was the case of Marina Mazzopolina, who is an opposition politician for a party called the Libertarian Party.
And this is in Russia. This is a small political party in Russia that she's involved
with. Exactly, yes. And Matsipelina, on the day Russia invaded Ukraine, she joined some other politicians to deliver a request for a protest. They thought it's a fairly minor symbolic gesture. But lo and behold, 9 days later, Matsipelina was woken in the early hours of the morning by police at her door. She assumes they wouldn't break down the door because in political cases in Russia, that rarely happens. But they did eventually break down her door and arrested her. And when she was at the police station, an officer, as he was booking her in, asked her if she knew how they had known she was in, because they won't normally break down the door unless they're sure that you're in. And she said, well, how? And he proceeded to read out her messages that she had been writing in a Telegram chat to 7 fellow members of her party as police were banging on her door.
Wow.
She wrote a Twitter thread expressing her concerns because she was 100% sure that none of her friends, very close friends and party colleagues in the chat would have been cooperating with authorities.
To confirm, did the dissidents in Russia, including Marina Matsipelina, did they think using Telegram was completely secure?
They did, yes. Most dissidents, most Russians generally, and I think most people around the world, to be honest, saw it as a very secure messaging service, partly because of Durov's history. He left Russia several years ago, shortly after launching Telegram, and he portrayed this as him going into exile under pressure from the authorities.
Darren, you looked into the insights the Kremlin could get from data taken from Telegram. What could authorities find out?
You can extract any public data that's on Telegram, and there's a lot of public data on there. Anything that anyone has posted publicly, an image, a message, and then it can be kind of catalogued, indexed. And once you do that at scale, you can actually find a huge amount of information about an individual user.
I know that when you and others started trying to find out what was going on, pretty quickly it led you to Pavel Durov, the very person that created Telegram. Did you determine that somehow he was involved in allowing Russian authorities to have access to Telegram?
There's no evidence for that, which should be stated clearly. But there's just a lack of transparency over how Telegram deals with requests from the authorities, how it has been allowed unhindered to operate in Russia, whereas Meta has been banned and the government has control of all the popular Russian internet companies. But Telegram has kind of been left alone. So there are a lot of questions from the activist and opposition community that are unanswered because Pavel Durov doesn't engage with them. He doesn't engage with civil groups that have requested many times for him to sit down and explain how Telegram deals with requests from the authorities. And there's also the fact Telegram was officially banned in Russia in 2018, and then it was unbanned in 2020 through some kind of deal with the authorities that neither side has ever shed light on what the deal was, what they specifically agreed to on either side.
Darren Loukaitis is a reporter who's done deep reporting on Telegram, most recently for Wired, in a story called The Kremlin Has Entered the Chat. He's based in Barcelona. Darren, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Now back to our top story today, that balloon that's been reported flying over Montana, Missouri, and Kansas. It's got all of our attention, but it turns out it's nothing new. As the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports, balloons have been used in espionage and warfare for hundreds of years.
The first ones to use them were the French in 1794 to spy on Austrian troops. Then in the U.S., a guy named Thaddeus Lowe convinced Abraham Lincoln to use balloons for reconnaissance during the Civil War. Tom Crouch at the National Air and Space Museum says Lowe demonstrated the newfangled spy balloon on the Washington Mall. He took a telegrapher up in the balloon with him and strung wires back down to the ground.
From 500 feet in the air, Thaddeus Lowe literally sent President Lincoln a telegram talking about what you could see from 500 feet in the air. Said he could see for 25 miles in any direction. He could see the army camps around the city. So pretty neat.
Lincoln was sold, and the Union Army Balloon Corps was born. Flash forward to World War I. Spy balloons were common, says Christopher Warren at the National World War I Museum and Memorial.
The British, the French, you know, all the major combatants, they used observation balloons to some extent.
Warren says there was one big leap forward, though, at the time.
The pilots of these observation balloons were actually given parachutes. A lot of times, the only way they could get down from these balloons, or if the balloons were shot and were losing air, is they had to jump over the side. It's significant because pilots in World War I did not use parachutes. They were not issued parachutes, but these pilots in these observation balloons were.
Next to World War II, when some spy balloons had a steel wire hanging from them. This served two purposes. One, the wire could damage enemy power lines. And two, it could be used to protect troops on the ground by preventing enemy planes from flying overhead.
These steel cables would cut the wings of World War II aircraft, so it created a flying hazard over areas. So that's another way that the technology advanced.
Now, the spy balloon floating somewhere over the central U.S. is clearly different from the balloons of yore. The technology is much more advanced. But Amanda Olke at the Spy Museum in Washington says spy balloons of today still have a lot in common with centuries ago.
In the Civil War, the balloons were not high up. They were not covert. They could be seen. So obviously, that's intimidating to your adversary. You've got eyes on them.
So the balloon grabbing headlines today, assuming it is a Chinese spy balloon, isn't just collecting intelligence. It's also sending a message.
This is just a little bit of intimidation, letting us know that a Chinese balloon can float freely over the United States. You know, it's certainly got everybody talking and worrying and wondering and scurrying. So very intriguing.
Intriguing indeed. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Milan in northern Italy pretty much has it all. It's a major metropolis with a beautiful historic city center. It's the hub for a hot fashion industry and a thriving finance sector. And nowadays, that's all capped off with a luxury housing market in the city that's going crazy. One thing that's likely to add fuel to the real estate frenzy is Brexit. Reporter John Last explains.
This three-story property that we're about to see is in this beautiful 19th century palazzo.
Flashy real estate tours of luxury properties like this one are dime a dozen on YouTube. But in Milan, one of Italy's most sought-after cities, apartments like this are becoming increasingly hard to find.
The property is 450 square meters, has three bedrooms, five bathrooms, a fitness area.
Milano has become a destination.
Marco Torelli runs a luxury real estate company in Milan. He says Milan was never really a major draw for the ultra-wealthy until about 5 years ago. Then the government introduced generous new tax breaks for Italian expats moving back and wealthy foreigners. Now, he says,
Milano is booming, absolutely booming.
For those seeking La Dolce Vita, Milano offers a walkable center with a high quality of life. And since Brexit, it's become a top destination for bankers pushed away from places like London. Sabrina Suma is an expert with Scenari Immobiliari, a real estate analysis firm.
I've got several friends who are coming back to Milan because of the companies that either are closed in UK or, you know, they've been called back to the country, and they all coming to Milan.
Under ordinary circumstances, this would be good news for Milan, and especially for those in the real estate business. But
the luxury residential market in Milan is very thin.
Roberto Magalio is another real estate agent.
When I have American clients, maybe coming from Miami, they ask me to show hundreds of properties, and why in Milan, especially. If you look at properties above 2 million, we are talking about dozens, maybe.
That's because Milan's city center is small, very small for a city of its size. And it's old, too, with few of the modern high-rises you can find in New York or London. That leaves luxury realtors trading whatever few flats they can find in the 19th century palazzi that crowd the streets of the historic center. To expand their offerings, some have tried to woo the ultra-wealthy to new buildings on the edges of the city, American-style developments with gyms, indoor pools, and common areas.
Obviously, for luxury market, most of these new developments are not interesting.
Here's Marco Torelli again.
for luxury market, we will come back to the 4.5 square kilometers, which is the luxury center of Milano.
And like everywhere else, where low supply meets high demand, you get surging prices. In the last 6 months of 2022, Milan's luxury property went up 25% in value. Sabrina Suma estimates a jump of 60% more over the next few years. Now, that's good news for investors. But what does that all mean for the rest of us? Suma says, on the one hand, the new luxury developments on the periphery are attracting more services to previously hard-up areas. But they also drive up rents with the promise of urban renewal.
Some other areas have increased by 15-20% since development was announced.
That's a problem, because there may not be much further that ordinary folks can go. Maria Chiara Scela is with an affordable housing cooperative called Dar Casa.
It's very difficult for families, of course, especially for low income, but also for middle income, to get a house in the free market.
Scela says that affordability problem is one reason why Milan is struggling to find key workers, teachers, bus drivers, and nurses. And this problem is likely to get worse. As the consequences of Brexit unfold, it's clear more businesses will be moving to the city. And Milan is hosting the Olympics in 2026. In some neighborhoods, prices are already skyrocketing. That means if Milan isn't careful, the city could become, in the words of one realtor, a ghetto for the ultra-wealthy, with bidding wars between rich people and dwindling numbers of residents in the city to serve them. For The World, I'm John Last.
Here's a startling number to come out of the pandemic. 1.5 billion children worldwide were impacted by school closures, and the effects have been severe. In a new French study that looked at 15 countries, the learning losses amounted to missing a third of the school year. Larry Aber has a few thoughts on this. He's a professor of psychology and public policy at New York University's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. Larry, you've read the study. Can you help us go a little bit deeper into its findings? I mean, what strikes you beyond that headline that a third of a year was just lost?
Plenty of things. The first is that while a third of the year was lost, there wasn't a cumulative loss beyond that. At first, we were afraid that you lose that amount of learning and it's just going to keep getting worse. Good news is it doesn't get worse. The bad news is it doesn't get better by itself either. The other striking thing from my point of view is that they're finding that kids in poorer socioeconomic backgrounds and countries that are relatively poor, the learning loss is greater.
Give us some examples of what education losses look like. I mean, how does it translate?
Children proceed over the course of their first 6 or 8 years normally from recognizing words to recognizing letters or characters to being able to make the sound for those letters and characters to identifying words based on the sounds to combining words in sentences to combine sentences in paragraphs and to combine paragraphs into longer forms of thought. That's a growth progression. The pandemic slows that growth progression in literacy.
I want to hone in on developing nations for a minute, where education losses were more pronounced. Is that just a matter of resources, lack of access to technology, or is it more nuanced?
I think it's more nuanced. Certainly, lack of resources and technology are part of it. But there are many aspects that have to do with the strength and resilience of education systems in countries. And I think that the poorer the country, the fewer assets they have to be resilient in the face of these kinds of exogenous shocks, these sudden things that blow in from nowhere and hit hard.
Of the 15 countries that were looked at, what are the two at the top that are doing the best? And what are the two at the bottom who are, you know, struggling the most in terms of this issue?
A couple of things to note. I would predict that the two countries that are struggling the most are two of the four middle-income countries, Colombia and South Africa. Those are countries that are also experiencing very significant armed conflict of various types. So countries that are affected by war and affected by enormous internal strife have a level of disorganization of the education system that's even greater than very poor countries without those things.
So based on this report, I mean, the damage has been done, a third of a school year lost. How can schools play catch up?
The good news is there are lots of ways that they could, and we're learning more and more about which of them actually work and which don't. I suggest two things. We've been studying programs like the ones the International Rescue Committee has developed, and they combine social-emotional learning with academic learning, and they have the exact effects we'd expect, which is it increases kids' sense of safety and security in the school. And when they feel more safe and secure, they are able to pay attention more and learn better academically. So remedial tutoring is, I think, an evidence-based approach. And some of the others are beginning to show evidence and could be combined into programs and policies that would make a difference.
Larry Aber is a professor of psychology and public policy at New York University's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
For 65 years, the Grammy Awards have celebrated the most commercially successful musicians from around the world. This year, Record of the Year nominees range from emotional ballads like Adele's Easy on Me. Dance pop hits like Beyoncé's Break My Soul. Then there are the songs that empower people and inspire global movements. This year, the Grammys are honoring those songs with a new award called the Best Song for Social Change. The World's Bianca Hillier has the details.
It's not technically a Grammy Award, but it's an award from the Recording Academy and will be presented at the Grammys. So bottom line, it's still a big deal. To qualify for this new category, songs have to include lyrics that address social issues of our time and inspire positive global impact. Members of the public sent in their top picks, including the song Equal Sign. The South Korean track is a solo hit from BTS band member J-Hope. It talks about treating everyone with respect and opening your mind to people across different ages, genders, and national boundaries. BTS fans, called The Army, have jumped on the song, and many have submitted it for Best Song for Social Change. It'll be up against another song called Changes by American hip-hop artist Twain. We suffer socially, locally, emotionally, while trying to figure where should our devotion be. Twain says the lyrics are about seeking human connection and solidarity through tough times. The top contender for Best Song for Social Change, though, is a track called Boroye, which means For the Sake Of. The song is by Iranian singer-songwriter Shervin Hajipour. Its lyrics are actually tweets written by people inside Iran during nationwide protests that followed the death of Mahsa Amini while in custody of the morality police. Iranian-American Holly Dagress of the Atlantic Council shared the song's significance with the world when it first went viral in the fall.
You hear everything from the ability to kiss their lover in the streets without fearing reprisal from the so-called morality police, or the ability to dance, and of course, for freedom. And so these lyrics really resonate with the average Iranian.
Shortly before voting for Best Song for Social Change closed, the Recording Academy said Boroye made up 82% of submissions thus far. Those submissions won't seal the deal, though. A special committee will determine who wins. The Grammy Awards air this Sunday night. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
from PRX.